Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Human Performance Outliers podcast with Zach Bitter. All right, Nicole, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Always an honor.
Yeah, so you've been doing some more podcast episodes lately. You're too deep into your series on talking to people who have had high caliber achievements, but also in sports, I should say, but also have a demanding career is sort of the premise, right?
Yeah, that's really what the focus is. And I think I just like to hear their stories and how they really have a sense of balance. Obviously, it's a challenge that I think a lot of people spend a lot of time thinking about, and how they can, you know, really do their best to tackle a lot of different things and try and perform at a high level. So that's always been something that I've been interested in hearing from others and their perspective.
Yeah, it's been fun to edit and publish those last couple, or actually the first couple episodes of that. And I'm looking forward to the rest of the series as well. But for this episode, we're going to talk about a topic that I think is an interesting one within the sport of ultra running, and that is training races. So I don't actually know how that became a thing. I mean, professional runners do tune-up races and other distances and things like that. But it seems like it's maybe there's a unique spin to it with ultra running, given the distance of a lot of the events where, you know, if you're going to be doing something like 100 miles or further than that, the draw or the kind of intuitive idea of going out and doing something that's still very long, relatively speaking, but shorter than that 100 mile or beyond 100 mile distance beforehand as a way to kind of tune up is the topic we're going to chat about here today.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, I think that's something that both of us have used as a strategy for many years. And I just think I personally have just appreciated taking this route simply because it makes it more sustainable from a training perspective, right? I personally don't love to necessarily be out on trails by myself for 9 hours. So being in a race, for example, that's just a good way to knock out a great training run, especially leading up to a 100 miler. Also, the aid stations, for example, right? The ability to have all the support, it just makes it a lot easier and more digestible, at least from my perspective. So I'm a big fan.
Yeah. You know, the reason I got interested in this topic is I think there is definitely both a physical thing to consider, and then there's also kind of the mental thing to consider, or just the peace of mind is maybe the way to look at it. It's just the psychological aspect of the sport, more or less. But like what you said, you know, like just like the idea of going out for a 9 hour long run on by yourself without the support of the event, and I guess it would be non-specific then too, is maybe a less desirable than going to the event, practicing all the event day stuff that's pretty unique to it, and having that those repetitions kind of in the back pocket heading into your longer session. The part I find interesting about the physical side of it though is just what is the value add or the opportunity cost for doing something like that. So the way I always explain it to my coaching clients is really what we're looking at in terms of like long-term improvement is the amount of volume you're able to spend training at the goal intensities at the highest quality. So the big issue when you get into these bigger workouts, because that's what this is, if you go and do a 100K or a 50 mile or even a 50K for that matter in training, is it's a big workout. And when you do big workouts, the first thing you should always ask yourself as a runner is, what is the opportunity cost of this versus what else I would do otherwise? So if you go out and do, let's just say, a 50 miler, and because you did that 50 miler now, that whole next week you do very little or no running, you do have to ask yourself, how much value would I have gotten above and beyond that 50 mile stimulus by doing something a little bit shorter, maybe 25 miles on your own, and then being able to kind of get back on the horse, so to speak, that next week and get a full training week in. And I think that's definitely something that people need to consider. And it's going to be one of those things where context matters, right? Where maybe you gave yourself a really good timeline for your goal race, so you've checked a lot of the boxes in terms of hitting the goal amount of volume at the right intensities at the highest amount of quality. You've got this buffer to do things like practice races and stuff like that. versus someone who's on kind of on a tight timeline. Every once in a while I'll have someone who I'm working with, they're like, oh, I want to do this race, and it's like 10 weeks away. Like 10 weeks is a pretty tight margin unless you've already kind of purposefully or unintentionally done a lot of the work on accident. So in that scenario, I don't know that I would be as inclined to suggest they do something like a 50 mile or midway through that, because that's if we lose an entire week of training of 10 to do that larger stimulus, it might not be worth that opportunity cost.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think when you go into a race and you're truly using it as a training run, for example, you definitely need to be mindful. And I think for a lot of people, it's challenging because some people get to the start of a race line and they want to race, right? They're not going to necessarily be able to take their foot off the gas or really utilize the strategy that it truly is a practice run. So I think you need to know yourself in that regard and really understand why you're lining up and stay true to that mindset, right? Mm-hmm. I think, I can say for my own purposes, there have been times I get to the starting line and I say I'm going to do it as more of a training run and it turns more into a race, right, for me. And so I think it's very important to really know why you're there and use it appropriately, because you're right. Otherwise, you can just put yourself back, especially if you're giving up a whole week of training. That may not be very beneficial. So I do think that's an important thing to think through. I think the longer I've been in the sport, the more I'm able to really truly understand the value of, you know, taking it easy or taking it easier than I would have, just so that I get that longer stimulus and use it to my advantage for future races. But again, something you definitely need to be mindful of.
Yeah, you preempted my next point, which was going to be, how do you actually go about the event itself? And the way I like to kind of somewhat subjectively kind of position it with someone, if they're thinking about this, is if you can go out there and hold back to say like 80% of your full capacity, then you're going to likely bounce back a lot quicker than if you say go out there and just redline it the whole time. And I think there's probably even some reason to believe that if you went out on an event like that and went out way too fast in the beginning and kind of blow up in a race like that, you're going to likely look at a little bit of a longer recovery period than if you go out slow and finish strong. So maybe it is a case where you're doing a B race or a tune-up race and you start out really conservative but finish strong. So those last few miles feel like they're a little closer to max, but since you position them at the end of the event versus the beginning, you're not necessarily like hammering your legs after that more aggressive start. And your mind too, because, you know, it's always a lot more mentally taxing when you do an event where you're just like holding on by a thread, trying to kind of force or will yourself to the finish line versus when you feel like you're just kind of powering through it. So those are things to consider. And sometimes I look at it, the personality of the runner too, where I'll just ask, are you the type of runner when you're on a starting line and the gun goes off, it's 100% no matter what? That person, I might tell them to do something a little differently with training races versus a person who has no problem just kind of keeping it at that like 80% capacity mark in terms of both when and how many of them we do, or just how the timeline is. Like I said before, if I have someone who's going to be more likely to go to 100% no matter what, if they pick an A race that's 10, 12 months in the future, well, we've got a timeline where they could do more than just that A race at 100% capacity, in which case then they've sort of earned themselves the ability to go out and do something a little bit more at full capacity and use that for what ultimately is going to be the race they care more about down the road.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I think is just really interesting too is, I kind of said it in the beginning to some degree, is just the uniqueness of racing in general. And this is true for any endurance race, but there's just a different kind of set of emotions, set of stress and anxiety, and even protocols as to like how you maybe go about things around an event. So doing an event versus waking up and just going for a training run also has that added value of practicing what you would do the day before, you know, what foods you're going to eat the night before and things like that, breakfast before the race, waking up probably earlier than normal in most cases with a lot of these races, and just kind of getting used to that routine of this is what I need to do before the race even begins. And then like you mentioned, Nicole, just to like navigating aid stations, figuring out things like when I'm building out my race pace strategy for my goal race, how much time should I give myself as far as non-moving time goes for things like bathroom breaks, aid station stops, stuff that's going to add to your finishing time but not actually be part of your moving pace. And those are things I think that are just a lot more specifically practiced in an event versus in a training race. So those are maybe some value adds that people go through the motions of but don't always recognize. So I usually tell people, when you're going to do a training race, let's make sure we take full advantage of it. And we're thinking about all of those things too. So you're extracting all the value from something that does have a trade-off.
Yeah, that makes sense. How else do you feel about just having a built-in kind of community around you? I mean, you essentially have cheerleaders at the aid stations, yeah, right, that are out there excited that you're racing or training. You also have just other runners, right? A lot of us don't necessarily have a group that they can always rely on for just a random Saturday 50-mile training run. So I think there's the added value of just having the support that may be valuable. I don't know your thoughts there.
Yeah. Yeah. You can definitely practice that, which is going to be mostly unique to it too. And just see how you respond to that sort of stuff. Because there are things too, like pacers and crew members, where sometimes people find that they differ in terms of how much of an incentive that's actually going to be for them. Where to the degree that some people don't even like crew and pacer, they'd almost just rather kind of remove all the logistics of managing that and just say, give me my bottle, my pack, I'm going to go to the aid station and take care of myself. And I think to some degree, like, that seems like super unstructured and haphazard, but there's that cognitive load that comes with these things, where if you're already reached that in your own mind, adding a bunch to it may not be worth a little bit of efficiency you're going to get, or the motivation that you're going to subjectively get from one person to the next having a pacer with you and things like that. So you learn a lot about yourself with the longer reps on race conditions too.
Yeah, I like that thought. I also, there's something to me about lining up at certain smaller events that makes me enjoy racing, right? Whereas if you're only lining up at really competitive races, sometimes I find that just the added stress of always being at those just loaded competitive feels just kind of sucks the joy out of it for me to some extent, because I feel like sometimes I just get so anxious. So there's just for me, taking part at races that I have grown up at, essentially, in running trails, I find a lot of value there. And it's almost like a reunion, right, to see old friends, especially in Texas. I love doing some of the races that are more local. And so I find a lot of value from that perspective as well. And I do think it keeps me more in a joyful state about racing and just reminds me of just being mindful that, you know, it's just a day on the trails.
Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this podcast sponsors include S Fuels. They have a 15% offer for you. Element Electrolytes, they have a free sample pack offer for you. John G Apparel has 10% off. And Delta G Ketones has a 20% off and free consultation offer for you. Links and details can be found in the show notes and the episode landing page. You can also check out a full description of how I use all of these products in my own training and racing at the end of this podcast episode. Yeah, you hit it on the head too. I think that gets into the why. And I think sometimes we assume that, like, our why is what everyone else's why is, and then we project that on other people or the rest of the community. When some people, the number one reason they do this is because they want to get out with a group of people and challenge themselves. And whether they are able to go to the maximum of their potential is a little bit less of a concern. They want to do well, I'm sure, but they also take the greater joy out of what you mentioned, having that kind of community experience. So for them, it's like the more of them they can do, reasonably speaking, the better. So it's some of its priorities as in terms of what the why is for the person as well. So I think sometimes it's easy for me, I know, to get kind of stuck in the lens of, like, what's the main goal and kind of prioritizing everything around that versus looking at it through multiple different lenses.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely a good point. I mean, it's very dependent on why you're out there. So whether maybe you have sponsors and you are trying to race at a very high level, or you're doing it truly for just your love of being out there, just to get in a run and be outside with nature, or it might just be on the spectrum, right? I think probably many of us fall and have different reasons, and just it's more complex than that. But I think that's a very good point. Do you want to tell us a little bit about some of the racing you've been doing this year, Zach?
Yeah. I think that's going to be a fun topic. Is one of the reasons we wanted to do this episode in the first place is we've kind of been in a spot where both of our training the last year has been very consistent. So one thing that I really like about being injury free and consistent in training is when you do end the process from one race and begin the next one, obviously a good off season so that you recover physically and mentally is appropriate. But a good off season, in my opinion, doesn't mean returning to baseline of no fitness. It means picking up maybe, or giving yourself a little bit of refresher where you do let go of some of that fitness, but not to the degree where you're going to need that same amount to get back up. So you're kind of pulling back a little bit, but that next push forward should take you further. And having that in place, I think, opens up the door for more training races. So we've been hopping around Texas a bit so far this year. What have we done? We did the Rocky Raccoon 50 mile, the J&J 50 mile. We've got the Brazos 50K coming up in about a week, or actually by the time this comes out, it'll have been over, I'm sure. So we'll have finished the Brazos 50K when
fingers
people listen
crossed,
to this.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
yeah. All going well. So yeah, I think we've been definitely leaning towards that. Let's use some training races, to get ourselves ready for our goal races this year. And so far, so good. I think, you know, in terms of the things we've talked mm-hmm. about so far, both of us, I think, basically bounced back after those with a day of rest and then kind of an ease back in for maybe the first half of the week. But then by the end of that following week, I think we're both back to full capacity. And that's not that big of an opportunity cost then.
No, it's been fun. And see a lot of friends, do a lot of racing. We definitely got poured on at the Rocky Raccoon 50 miler. So that was added adventure, which haven't mm-hmm. done in a number of years. So,
well, and it's one of those things too, where if we want to get into some of the uniqueness of ultra running and why practicing race day stuff is got like a different variable to it than maybe some other endurance events, is the fact that, you know, we did two races, both the same distance. One was just soaking wet mud puddles all over the place, and the other one was just dry, loose rocks, very technical terrain. So it was like you kind of learn your variance in both different weather systems as well as different courses as to like maybe what works and what doesn't work, and start identifying kind of what are your kind of main favorite pieces of gear that are more transferable and ones that are going to be maybe a little more specialized. I know I'd like to hear if you had anything like this, but I know for me, I actually ended up discovering the update to the Ultra Timp 5. I hadn't worn that shoe before Rocky 50 because it hadn't been released yet, but it was just like in terms of like toe protection versus the other Ultra models that I've worn recently, that one was just like a notch better for my specific foot. So both the Rocky 50 mile and the J&J 50 mile, I don't think my toes have ever been in better shape after 50 miles of running. So to me, it was like, oh, I identified a gear piece that I'm going to have now in the back of my mind when I'm doing something even longer than that, if it's a scenario where I'm a little nervous about, you know, blisters or toe health and things like that throughout the course of a longer session. And now I have two very different environments to stress test that.
Yeah, the new Timp update is awesome. I wore those at Rocky as well, and I really thought they did great on that during that terrible torrential rain, right? where basically we were swimming on the course. And so I thought they were great. I wore the Mont Blanc Carbon at J&J, and I love those shoes as well. So all the new trail ultras are really.
It's actually funny because you typically are more likely to just have like a road shoe and a trail shoe, and you use it basically for everything because mm-hmm. you really like it. Whereas I'm maybe a little more likely to like rotate through different pairs for different environments, but for whatever reason, it's early. We've done two races. We'll see how this continues, but it is funny. But I think it'd be interesting just to maybe give the listeners some ideas of maybe what things to be looking for when they do these training races. So when they do go into them, they are kind of taking inventory on stuff. If you want to share some stuff that you're maybe paying attention to, then I can fill in the gaps with what I would say if there's anything
different. Yeah, a couple of things. First off, I don't like to travel too far away, at least. And again, this is just specific to me. I like to have something that I can easily roll up to on a Friday and then be able to try and get back by the end of the weekend. And that's simply because some of my bigger races are far away. So I know I have Mount Fuji coming up, which I'm very excited about. But just knowing that my training races are close by makes it just more easier. It just makes it easier for me and more palatable with my schedule and the other demands that I have going on. So that for me is something I think a lot about. I also want to the best of my ability, find courses that may be more specific to what I am going to be trying to navigate for the longer races that I'm doing. And again, it's not always perfect, right? I'm probably in Texas. I'm not realistically going to find a course that naturally ties with Mount Fuji. But that being said, I can say that J&J had some more technical terrain. I also know there are runnable sections on the Mount Fuji course, so Rocky Raccoon and Brazos are more in line with those. I think those are things that I think about. I also just have of the mindset that I want to enjoy my time in the training races. So I try and pick events that I know naturally are going to be something that is just enjoyable to me. So all of those are what goes into play for my thought process. But curious if I've left anything off that you think about.
Yeah, I was thinking more specific to like gear and stuff like that. Oh. But like that's actually a good point because, I mean, obviously, yeah, there's a logistics side of just getting to these events a lot of times. And it gets different from one person to the next because we're a little bit spoiled here in Texas where we have two race organizations between Tejas Trails and Trail Racing Over Texas that offer multiple events over the course of the year. So we're usually within a 3-hour drive of any of these. And then when we were in Phoenix, we were even more spoiled with Aravipa, who puts on, I think, over 50 events a year now. Yeah. So, but that's a good point. Like, I think really like the experience can be had regardless of the logistical hurdle from a travel standpoint. So if you're considering how much opportunity cost am I going to have with this, and it is like, oh, I got to fly to the other side of the country, deal with time zone changes, lose training on both ends, probably just reacclimating and things like that. You might be looking at a couple extra days of recovery when you're traveling more for it. So if you can find something closer to home, that might be an ideal scenario. Or it may be a deciding factor if you're on the fence as to whether to do one or not, as to like, well, what actually goes into that. So it's really good points. Some things that I think about when I'm doing these a lot of times is just a lot of the gear check stuff. So usually I have an idea before I even start training if I'm thinking way ahead of like, well, what is this race going to require? So like if I'm doing like a track ultra, it's maybe a little different than say if I'm doing something like Javelina where you can see your crew once every 20 miles or Western States where it's point to point and you're going through like basically three very unique different environments and you don't see your crew much at all. So you're doing a little more aid station navigating and things like that. So I'm always thinking about like, how does this pack feel on me when I'm out there for say like closer to 9 hours, like J&J versus just a typical 2 to 3 hour long run? Or how does this handheld bottle work if I'm using it all day versus just for a single run and things like that? Am I going to get like tired of one? Is there a way I can like switch between the two because you just get kind of more frustrated with a certain setup after a while and you want something to change? I find with the longer races, like I tend to look for things to change when I can. And I remember one of the more apparent versions of that was, I think it was the first year I did Javelina. I had this rotation going where every lap I'd switch from a pack to handhelds. And I remember every time I'd finish the lap, I was like, oh, it feels so good to take that pack off and grab the handhelds. And by the time I'd finished that lap, I'd be like, I'm sick of these handhelds. Give me the pack back. And it was just like, it was like the perfect timing to like want that. And you can learn that stuff by like your tolerance for certain things, or just things like chafing, blistering, spots that are maybe a little more problematic for you versus others in terms of how you want to kind of prepare things to get ready for that. So, I mean, that's a gear thing. I think there's also the nutrition and hydration side of things. So things as simple as like, what type of fuel am I going to be able to lean on the most? And is there a point where I start losing interest in it versus my favorite thing to have maybe is bulletproof for 2 to 3 hour sessions, but am I still going to want to be taking in enough of that at 8, 9, 10 hours into something? You can kind of sense out maybe some of that palate fatigue or that variance that you want and plan your nutrition accordingly. And then hydration too. I think the interesting thing is like, you know, you get these nice cool mornings at the start of a lot of these races and you might only need like 500 milliliters or less per hour. Whereas you get into the heat of the day and you might get closer to, some people are well over a liter per hour in some cases. I think at Javelina, I hit almost a liter per hour on average when it got a little warmer out there. So just kind of recognizing how that shifts over the course of the day, and it's not necessarily plug and play the whole way. It could be in a shorter session, I think are all good things to pay attention to and practice and learn more about when you're doing things like training races.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense.
And if it's Nicole, it's more about like, what can I get away with from the aid stations randomly?
Yeah, that's so true. Like, that is totally my MO.
Avoid this or lean towards that.
Yeah, I'll totally agree.
I'll never forget the first time I ever paced and crewed you was at the Black Canyon 100K in, was it 2017, I think?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. The first time, it was the aid station that was just before mile 20. And you come through and you hadn't eaten much yet that day. So you started to recognize, okay, I need to get on top of this. So you come out of the aid station with like two fists full of just random aid station stuff. You had like a muffin, a cookie.
I think it was all gummies.
Yeah, you
I
had
think
gummy
it was
bears
all gummy bears.
Gummy worms,
I think that's
yeah.
all I ate that day were gummy bears. Gummy worms.
I feel like I remember a muffin, but maybe I
didn't eat it. I remember that day all I ate was, I mean, not that I ate so many of them, but I ate so many gummy worms.
Yeah.
Not
that's
bears,
right.
worms. The I gummy remember worms. By the end I was like, I probably had like 50 gummy worms. It was just the day.
Yeah. So I think you can learn some of that stuff too, because there is, you know, obviously like the kind of rule of thumb is don't do anything on race day you haven't practiced. But there's also like, how do you practice something when it's 70 miles into a race? So there's also this ultra running specific thing where like, to some degree, trust your intuition, where like if you go into an aid station at later in a race and you're like, oh man, those salty crackers or pretzels look, or chips, whatever happens, you look so good right now. Well, maybe that's because your body is getting kind of a little bit of a palate fatigue from like liquid, gel, sweeter flavored stuff. Maybe you're getting a little low on sodium, so the salty food's starting looking a little better. And I think to some degree, trusting that is worth doing, and trusting your intuition a little bit. I think you want to be careful with that stuff though. And what I tell people is like, your eyes are going to be bigger than your stomach at like, probably like a 4 or 5 times the normal. Like if you think of like when you're really hungry, you think, okay, I could eat like a whole bunch of stuff. And when you start actually eating, you realize, okay, I didn't really actually need to eat that much stuff. When you're running, it's like an extreme of that. So you can go through an aid station and maybe they have like peanut butter jelly sandwiches there. Very easy to grab one and just start eating the whole thing right away. And then once you start moving again, realizing that wasn't a good idea. You're better off having like a little bit, nibbling on it for a little bit, letting it settle, and then nibbling on more of it and kind of slowly introducing it. And things like that, that maybe wouldn't occur to you when you're kind of just in your normal training, because you're probably not going to be in a state where you get to a point in training where you're just like at that spot of palate fatigue or just really being hungry to the level where you're going to eat a full sandwich or something like that. But you can learn those, make those mistakes on training races, or learn about like kind of the dosage tolerances you have for different things at those extended durations, I think are also things that people should keep in mind when they're kind of practicing this stuff in their training races.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah. The other thing I always find interesting with this too, and this is one that Nick Curry, our friend, and even negative split of ultra running will say is there's this kind of desire in ultra marathon running to bank time, because you're like, well, it's going to be long, it's going to be tough at the end no matter what, but I need to go a little bit faster than average in the beginning to account for that slowdown. When in reality, I don't know that that necessarily is the case, but it seems to be like this intuitive impression people have. And it's really hard to kind of get over that and try something like an even or even a negative split when you're kind of the stakes are there for your A race. So I think practicing things like pacing at these can be really useful too, where now you don't necessarily have that same level of incentive to maybe feel like I have to execute this perfectly. And then you can practice something like that by going out really slow relative to what you maybe think, and then just see what that experience is like. Because I know for me personally, the first time I ever ran a race where I was, you know, even close to an even split, was like such a weird eye-opening experience to me, where I was just like, I didn't know I could feel this good at the end of one of these longer races as I did. And that was a takeaway for me to like, well, if I can figure out what my optimal goal time actually is and pace closer to even with that, I'm just going to have a better experience and likely finish faster. And it's a little easier to commit to practicing that when you're doing training races than when the stakes are out there.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Just having that opportunity to practice is a plus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe a quick reminder of just a review maybe before we sign off here about like what are the pros and potential negatives of doing training races is I think the pros are you're practicing specific race day stuff all the way from pre-race to how you sleep the night before, foods that work well before races, things like that, your inter-race gear, inter-race nutrition, fueling, hydration, weather pattern changes that are likely going to be a little more severe than what you'll get on a typical run. And then some of the stuff you said, Nicole, like community experiences, like just being part of the community or getting out at more events, which I think are draws for people too. Practicing pacing, all that stuff that we mentioned. Potential downsides, obviously, is the opportunity cost. I think just you're doing a hero workout, as they say. So, you know, you want to be mindful of what you're taking off the table. What does your timeline look like leading into your goal race? And what are the travel logistics if you are to do this? What's your personality type in terms of how you're going to actually approach this? Or, you know, some personalities just don't need the practice the same way. They're a lot better at maybe reflecting back at their last race that they did from the prior season or the prior A race that they did and being able to carry that stuff forward versus others who maybe are still learning more stuff or need more practice. But considering the totality of things where it's like trying to get the most amount of volume at the right intensities at the highest quality over the course of your training and how much of that impact gets affect or how much doing training races impact that are all very much worthwhile to consider when you're doing these things.
Yeah, no, all good points.
Yeah. And I will add one thing that I did forget to say that you kind of alluded to when you said like I think smaller races. When you said that, I thought to myself, smaller as in shorter distance, because it's like some of the stuff I talked about in terms of practice could be done at a very short race too. Like yeah. You still get that same kind of pre-race kind of energy at like a 5K or a 10K. So, you know, if you're really worried about the training load side of the equation and you also want to practice things like how do I feel the day before an event? How do I navigate the morning, getting to the start line, stuff like that? Obviously, you're not going to be able to practice gear the same way or your nutrition the same way for something like that. So there is a trade-off there. But there are some things you can practice with very low opportunity cost events too. So if that's what you're after, then, you know, jump in your local 5K, I guess.
Yeah, all good thoughts.
Cool. Got anything else, Nicole? Anything else about training races or ultra running in general?
I think that captures my thoughts.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me for this topic-based episode. I think we'll have some more in the future that'll be fun to chat about.
Absolutely.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Human Performance Outliers podcast with Zach Bitter. Hey everyone, if you are here, you have stuck around to hear more about how I use the products that sponsor the Human Performance Outliers podcast. I have taken a lot of time identifying these products and brands, and I'm incredibly grateful that they are both products that I'm able to use sometimes on a daily basis, and they also are interested in supporting what I'm doing here at the Human Performance Outliers podcast and want to work with me. So here's how I use them. One of the reasons I came across S-Fuels originally is it maps my protocol perfectly. So at S-Fuels, they follow a principle of right fuel at the right time. This means that they don't demonize carbohydrate, but they understand the power of a low carbohydrate diet. So throughout my year, I have ranging inputs between fats and carbohydrates, but they're always based in a foundation of fats. S-Fuels approach matches that just right. It allows you to build a foundation in your nutrition with fats, but also gives you options to pull that powerful lever that is carbohydrate when you need it. So in their product line, this is how I use it. Race Plus, that's their carbohydrate source. I'll use this for faster workouts or for races when I'm trying to defend muscle and liver glycogen. Train is their fat-based powder, which is basically a sports drink powder, but with fat instead of carbohydrate. Helps improve fat oxidation rates. I love it for workouts where I need some calories. I don't want to run a huge deficit, but I don't want to introduce carbohydrates. Side note, this actually makes a great high-fat smoothie as well. So if you're interested in that, check out my Instagram reels. I've got some smoothies on there that I've used this for. Revival is a protein powder that I will use post-workout and post-race a lot of times. This is something I can easily mix into something like full-fat yogurt or in that high-fat smoothie that I mentioned. Using this just makes sure I'm getting off on the right foot with the recovery process and maximizing my protein muscle synthesis. Next is Primed. Primed is my go-to caffeine source when working out. It gives you 80 milligrams of caffeine, but they make it in a way where it will help with focus, won't have jitters, and can help you with the fat oxidation benefits of caffeine consumption, as well as the reduction in perceived effort. Life bars are my go-to snack. If I'm doing a pretty big training block and I need something between meals, Life bars give me some healthy fats and protein that'll fit right into that. Finally, Keto 3. Keto 3 is a product that I'll use basically to replace anything I would have used granola for in the past. So I keep a bag of this around and I can sprinkle that on top of things that I would have previously put granola on when I want to keep the fats and the proteins high and the carbohydrates low. If you want to learn more about these products or check them out, head over to sfuelsgolonger.com where you can get 15% off your order. And this year, stay tuned because I'm going to be doing a series of free sample pack offers from those products that I just talked about. Last year, some of my trail running friends told me I needed to check out this brand named Jonji. And when it came time to update my running apparel, I thought, okay, I'm going to check these guys out. I'm stoked that they want to work with me because I've ended up using this stuff for way more things than I actually thought I would. My main focus when I'm picking out workout gear and specifically running gear is how does it actually like sit on my body while I'm going through the different mechanics that are important to running or strength work and things like that. So the more a product can function the way it's supposed to, but stay out of the way, the better as far as I'm concerned. So their kind of lightweight, breathable, moisture wicking type of setup works really well for me. They're shorts, they're AFO middle short. I actually got two pairs of these and I find myself using this for everything basically. Like I've used them for short intervals, I've used them for long intervals, taking them out for long runs, easy runs. I even go to the gym with them. So I need both those pairs. I've been going through them. They have an odor resistant tack to it too. So I can usually get a few workouts out of them before I need to wash them. And I just find like my range of motion is great in it regardless of whether I'm doing those short intervals, long run in the gym doing mobility routine type stuff or like muscular endurance strength stuff and all sorts of different activities. So that short is going to be in my rotation even when the temperature picks up. I got a couple long sleeve options too from them. There's the Repeat Merino long sleeve and the Rover Merino hoodie. So the Repeat Merino I've been using as kind of like either a base layer if it's really cold out that I'll put on first and then something else over it. Or if it's just kind of chilly where like a t-shirt or a singlet isn't quite enough and I may want it for part of the run but not all the run, or maybe I want it for the whole run but I don't want too much so I feel like I'm sweating profusely underneath that. This is perfect for that. So I'll use it over the singlet or just straight up first layer on and then something over top of it. The Rover Merino hoodie is one of the things that I'll use as kind of an outer layer. I'll put this over that Merino long sleeve. And this one has a few extra features to it. It's a little thicker, so I can get away with it in a little cooler weather. But it also has like a hood that you can put up and then a face mask that covers part of your face that you can use too if it gets especially chilly out there. I've been using this both for the running workouts as well as taking it to the gym from a transportation standpoint as I'm getting there, and then during my warm-ups and things like that as something I can kind of count on. Both these items are super light and packable too, so if I do have a scenario where I think I might need it for part of the workout but not all of it, I don't hesitate to bring it because I know I can take it off and store it pretty easily if I need to without having to worry about feeling like I've got this like extra thing coming with me that is getting annoying. The next item I got from there was the tights. Now, tights are products that I am very skeptical about usually because I always end up having this situation occur where they either feel like too tight and restrictive or they feel like they're sagging on me. So I'm either feeling restricted by them, or if I don't feel restricted, I feel like I'm constantly trying to pull them back up or find a way to like fit them on me so they don't sag down. And it's just this constant battle where I just usually avoid wearing tights if I have to. These ones are much different than that. I'm loving these. I'm wearing these on all the cold weather days where I want that full protection layer, and they sit on me so perfectly. I can even stuff stuff in the side pockets. They've got these side pockets on either side. I put my phone in there. I've even taken my outer layer off and rolled it up and stuffed it in that side pocket. I don't feel like it's creating a situation where it's getting in the way or causing it to sag. Also, full range of motion. I've used this for faster runs and slower runs, and that's usually my test. If I can do a speed workout in the short in the tights, then that's great because that means I'm moving through my gait cycle smoothly. And if they're not sagging on top of it, that's a bonus. I also picked up their Atlas Multi Pant, which is a little bit more robust than the tights. So if you're looking for something for more of an outer layer, a little warmer, this would maybe be a little bit of an option. I've been using it on colder days for running and just as a way to wear something warm to get to the gym or during my warm up during that. I love these because they taper down really nicely, so I'm not catching it on the side of my shoe as I'm going through my gait cycle or a movement in the gym. But they also have these really long zippers on the side, so if I do want to peel them off or put them on, I don't have to take my shoes off or feel like I'm fumbling around with it a lot. They also pack. They pack up real nicely too, so you can roll them up into the back pocket, and then if I do find that I'm taking them off partway through a workout, I don't feel like I have this like extra piece of gear that's like bogging me down much. If you're interested in checking out Jonji, you can get a 10% discount. Use promo code BITTER10, that's BITTER10, and go to janji.com. That's JANJI.com. And if you do like to shop at REI, they are also available there. Element Electrolytes has been my electrolyte of choice for quite some time now. They're actually back sponsoring the podcast for the third year. It's how long I've been using them. I actually got my sweat test done last summer where I found out that I lose 614 milligrams of electrolytes for every liter of fluid that I lose. And it's not uncommon that I'll lose a liter plus of fluid per hour, especially when it gets a little bit warmer. So I'm usually using electrolytes in my workouts, especially as they go beyond an hour or if the temperatures are a little bit warmer, or if I'm just going through a lot of fluids for one reason or the other. My protocol right now is I'll do a half a pack of one of their chocolate flavors in my coffee in the morning before my morning training session. And then I'll do another half a pack to a full pack of usually watermelon in my fluids that I'm taking on during and after that workout. Their product specifically has 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, and 60 milligrams of magnesium. So you can go a long way with one packet. Some of the other flavors they have available are citrus, watermelon, orange, grapefruit, raspberry, chocolate, mango chili, chocolate caramel. They actually right now just rolled out their seasonal options. One reason to keep an eye on Element is they will do seasonal releases where they have limited time offers. And right now their seasonal option is chocolate mint, chocolate chai, and chocolate raspberry. If you check them out and you like that sort of idea of mixing something with your tea or coffee or your hot chocolate, if you want to make yourself some hot chocolate with this, you can do that. Definitely check out the mint and the chocolate raspberry. I love both of those. If you do want to try them out, you can actually get a free sample pack right now with your first purchase. You just have to go to drinklmnt.com/HPO. Put in that /HPO and that'll offer up that free sample pack, as well as let them know that you're a supporter of the Human Performance Outliers podcast. Delta G Ketones is a product I've been using for just over a year now. I started using them early last year as a test to see if it was something I was going to want to use in my training and racing. I wanted to stress test them in something longer, so I actually used them at the Rocky Raccoon 100 as my first kind of test of will these handle for the duration of a 100 miler versus just what I would notice in kind of day-to-day workouts and things like that. And they are something that I'm going to keep in my routine. So my basic go-to is the Delta G Performance. The reason I chose Delta G over all the other exogenous ketone supplements out there is they have a formula and a dosage that is supported by the research that we have to date. So they are the company that got the DARPA funding to design for special forces. They've been 50 plus published studies, 20 plus ongoing studies. My protocol with them is just to take a single bottle of that Delta G Performance before a key workout or before a race. And if I'm going to be doing a race that spans longer than 3 hours, I will take another bottle every 3 hours while I'm out there. So if you're interested in more details about exogenous ketones and Delta G specifically, I would encourage you to check out episode 351, Exogenous Ketones and Performance with Brian McMahon. You can also right now on their website, they understand that this is something that is new for people and they want to make sure that you are using it right and that you know what you're doing. So you can do a free consultation with them if you go to their website at deltagketones.com. If you do decide, hey, I want to check this stuff out and see what my experience is like, you can get 20% off and let them know you support HPO by using promo code BITTER20. That's BITTER20 for 20% off at deltagketones.com.